Hi, Reen.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
I'm well, and you?
I'm not too bad. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, and this is an episode of Worldwise on Blogging Heads TV, and you are Reem Maghribi. And I am in Istanbul, where I'm not accustomed to being, and you are in Beirut, right?
I am.
You want to tell us a little bit about your background and what you're doing there?
Okay. I'm a media consultant, a communications consultant, so I help organizations set up new media channels. I'm based in Beirut. I've been here for a year, primarily because I had been living in Syria before that, but my husband is a Belgian journalist, so both a foreigner and a journalist, they didn't like him anymore in Syria and didn't renew his visa. I was in Syria for 3 years before we left it, and there I was the editor of the only English language newspaper that Syria had, a daily newspaper. And before that, I was in London.
Okay. I think Syria is somewhat in the news for both of us. I mean, from where I am in Istanbul, it's in the news because a Turkish jet was shot down by Syria, a reconnaissance plane that had briefly been in Syrian airspace, but apparently was shot down after leaving Syrian airspace. And that's kind of a big deal here. In fact, I don't know if this is, here's the headline from a local paper today. Turkish government puts border troops on red alert. There has been some intersection with Lebanese politics as well, because there are pro-Syrian factions there, right?
Yes, there always have been. Back in the days of the civil war, Syria was in Lebanon. They had to withdraw a few years ago. But politically, I mean, Hezbollah is also in parliament, and they support the Syrian regime. So yes, but I'm quite surprised and pleased that Lebanon and the Lebanese politicians are insisting people don't get involved with the problem in Syria, because they've been through 17 years of civil war. They don't need a problem next door to spill over here and bring back those days. So there have been some skirmishes in Tripoli in the north and here in Beirut where I am, but nothing to suggest that the civil war that is going on in Syria will turn into a civil war in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. And is Hezbollah saying very much, because nominally they are still aligned with Syria, but I'm not sure how much they want to emphasize that right now as the prospects for the Syrian regime begin to maybe look bleaker?
Yeah, no, Nasrallah came out a while ago, and the skirmishes happened in the north of Lebanon, and he said that stay peaceful, that's not have this affect our unity in Lebanon. Well, it's a fragile unity, and the government is fragile, but they've been living with it for years. So even Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, has not been encouraging in any way any sense of getting Lebanese politics or people on the ground involved in the conflict in Syria.
Okay. Which I guess is good. So what is your take on the Syrian situation as someone who has been there, as someone who spent actually a fair amount of time there and has a Syrian parent?
Yes, my mother's Syrian, and I also spent every summer of my life in Syria, so I do know it well. What's my take on it? It's going to last at least another few months. The longer it lasts, the longer it will last after the regime actually exits, regardless of which way it exits, because there are divides and schisms and basically a crisis, an internal crisis developing, which is quite natural in times of war. And much as we don't like to say that we're in civil war, that's ultimately, according to the technical definition, where Syria is at. And the longer there is fighting, the more these divisions will happen, because people are always trying to choose the winning, trying to choose the winning side, which is inevitably it's not going to be the Assad's, but who will it be? That's unclear. But I think still we're a few months ahead, particularly as there doesn't seem to be any likelihood that Turkey will get involved militarily, regardless of the fact that it could, I'm not saying it should, but it could, internationally there seems to be no appetite for getting involved militarily. So it's up to the Syrians, and they've been fighting hard, but it will take some time.
Well, they are getting arms from, well, it's not clear to me from whom they're getting arms, but...
Saudi and Qatar. Financially, it's from Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And the CIA is in the south of Turkey distributing those arms on the basis that they want to make sure they don't end up in the wrong hands. So they're facilitating or logistically managing that inflow of arms. But that's also a recent thing in Turkey facilitating this arms movement. Previously, people had joked that it was easier to smuggle arms from Lebanon, where there are still factions, political and on the ground, that support the regime in Syria, than it was in Turkey. But things are changing. Politically, the opposition seems to be slowly but surely unifying and managing itself in a way conducive to the development of a stronger opposition that could eventually really topple the regime.
Right. And we should say that I'm sure from Syria's point of view, the background of shooting down the Turkish jet is that Turkey probably looks from Damascus like a hostile power, but because of the role in sponsoring, or at least hosting, you know, providing a place for these groups to coordinate.
Turkey hasn't really done very much. It's what I would call turn a blind eye. Yes, there are a lot of refugees there, but they're in camps funded by UNHCR. The CIA and Saudi and Qatar are really the ones involved in the arms smuggling. Turkey is facilitating it by not preventing them from being at the border on their soil. But if they were to prevent, then that means they are supporting the Assad regime. So they're obviously not going to want to do that. But generally, since the beginning, Turkey's bark... Actually, I don't even think its bark has been particularly loud. Even this week after the jet got shot down, they called for a NATO meeting under Article 4, not 5. Article 5 would be, we are concerned for our safety, we want to discuss military options, whereas Article 4 is more of a diplomatic discussion. It's been ever so softly barking for some months now. But I don't think Syria is actually particularly or has any reason thus far to be concerned that Turkey intends to militarily intervene.
Yeah. Now, yesterday, Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey did start talking a little tougher in the wake of this shoot down. He says, quote, the rules of engagement of the Turkish armed forces have changed given this new development. Any risk posed by Syria and the Turkish border, etc., will be considered a threat and treated as a military target. Of course, to some extent, he has to say something at least that tough for domestic reasons after a jet has been shot down. So that doesn't necessarily signify new belligerence, but it's, you know, in Turkey, in the Turkish media, there's a lot of attention on what seems to be a heightening of tensions. And of course, if something like this did, turn into actual war, I assume that would then become an occasion for the acceleration of regime change in Syria. And I don't know to what extent it would draw, the other powers overtly into the war, but I'm sure that America and the Arab countries you just alluded to would be certainly supporting that.
It seems nobody really wants to get involved in a full-scale international or even regional war in Syria, which is understandable for many reasons. It's not in Turkey's interests at the moment to get involved beyond how it has been. It has various considerations. It itself doesn't want NATO involved because I think Turkey feels that it is an important power in the region and should be able to take care of such issues. They weren't in favor of NATO's intervention in Libya, so why would they be in favor of their intervention in a country next door? Rasmussen of NATO made it very clear at the NATO summit in Chicago in, I think, April, that they had absolutely no intention of getting involved in Syria. That doesn't mean it won't happen inevitably, but it's suggesting that now no one wants to go there. The CIA and the Americans, they're involved in a very simple logistical way, perhaps actually to take care of their own interests, certainly, so that they're concerned weapons get into the wrong hands, like they inevitably did in Libya. They don't want that happening in such a fragile region as the Levant. And yes, and for Turkey, they have so many considerations, the Kurds and Iran, and it's very unclear what would happen if they put boots on the ground in Syria. So it doesn't look like anyone is physically going in, a foreign intervention is happening anytime soon. But the fact that the opposition is being armed in Syria should move things along a bit more quickly. There are a few more defections, and they get announced every week, but they're still not that many. We're waiting basically for the tipping point, and you can never predict when that will be. So, mm-hmm.
And are you suggesting that from Turkey's point of view, I mean, there's certain ambivalence about its relationship with NATO. Is that part of this? I mean, is Turkey standing in the Islamic world kind of made a little bit more awkward by the fact that it's part of the NATO alliance, or is that not what you're saying?
Not in relation to Syria. I don't think that's an issue there, at least not yet. I think Turkey, for example, developed a strong relationship with the regime in 2010. We saw it play out. Erdogan used to be in Syria almost monthly. They cancelled visas, or at least discussed it. The trade relations improved. There was a lot of development between Syria-Turkey relations in 2010. So when the uprising started, Erdogan almost made an announcement to his Western allies that he would sort this out, that he would find a way for Assad to impose the reforms necessary to calm the situation down. Hmm. And he kind of looks like he's got egg on his face because Bashar al-Assad did not react well at all to the uprising and did not implement the reforms necessary. And so Turkey showed that it didn't have the influence that it thought it would. And so it still wants to be that player. Everyone seems to be vying for this position of key player in the Middle East. Qatar was doing that during the Libya revolution. And it's not clear who's going to come up with a solution that will work in Syria. But I can't imagine also why anyone would want a NATO intervention in their backyard, and Turkey would get completely sucked in because it's a neighboring country to Turkey and because they are part of the alliance.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what is your reading of the situation within Syria? I mean, there's a lot of concern I've heard about how kind of coherent the situation would be after the fall of the Assad regime. You know, there's been a lot of talk about how many different rebel groups there are, about how little unity there is. You alluded to the fact that in distributing weapons in Turkey, two rebels, outside powers, are trying to, I gather, impose a little more unity within the opposition by, you know, by who they choose to give the weapons to and under what terms they give them the weapons, right?
They've always been doing that, Bob. Internally, when there were limited weapons, they would. They're very well organized. I must say, from the beginning, politically.
By they, you mean the outside powers? Or
the local coordination committees. I think what's happening actually is the Assad powers and the armed forces of the regime are slowly not communicating anymore and carrying out their own attacks in different regions, whereas at the same time the opposition movements is and has been from the various people that I know still in there and involved, the local coordination committees for the opposition and the Free Syrian Army, the FSA, have organized very local teams. And so when there were protests and they wanted to arm people for defense, they would, before the protest, hand out the arms to individuals, record their details or take their ID, and then at the end of the protest, they would take back the weapons and give them back their ID. So they already wanted to make sure that we didn't have a situation as in Libya, where everybody was armed during the struggle all the time, or when it was over, which nobody expected to really last this long, but it has, and it will for some time, because both sides are determined. And on a local level, though, on a ground level, there has been organization, there has been unity for some time. But certainly revenge killings, for example, sectarian tensions, these are things that the regime itself has encouraged through its propaganda and its general dialogue. When you say, if you get rid of me, there will be sectarian tension, you're threatening it, and to a degree you're therefore inviting it to happen. And of course the fact that a minority of the country has been in power for so long, and therefore those who are powerful are now fighting against the uprising, creates this divide. And so yes, you can talk about sectarian divides here, and therefore concern about individuals and revenge killings happening now and later. But in general, the opposition is still united, but certainly more armed than it was. It definitely, for many months, despite constantly being shot at by the regime, was a peaceful movement. But yes, we've moved on to a new stage in the revolution, which is quite natural after a year and a half.
Right, and I guess some people would say that, the character of a resistance can change. And, Egypt in a very different way is an example, where the people who kind of led the resistance at the beginning are kind of not really the people who wound up in power. In a way, the power is where it was all along in Egypt, in the sense that the military has a lot of it. But even the Muslim Brotherhood was not in the forefront of the resistance initially.
Well, not in the revolution of 2011, Bob. But the Muslim Brotherhood was the only active resistance movement, if you want to call it that, for decades.
Right.
So politically, they have been in opposition for decades, and so that they were able to organize themselves politically very quickly is no surprise. Whereas the liberals, for example, who did certainly, the young liberals who certainly were the majority in Tahrir at the beginning, they were not an organized group. They were motivated by Tunisia. They didn't expect to get rid of the great Mubarak in just 3 weeks. So that would explain to a degree the political results we have now. Add to that, obviously, the fact that SCAF, the Egyptian military, have been playing hardball.
Right. Right. I guess I just meant that at first it seemed like a secular liberal movement, as you suggested, and now the secular liberals are pretty much on the sidelines. And the question people raise about Syria is, at the beginning, that seemed, from afar at least, kind of like a secular liberal movement involving a lot of exiles. And here the parallel with Egypt breaks down, because here what we're talking about is something that then evolves into an armed conflict. And the concern is that then the power winds up with whoever is most active in the actual fighting. And of course, I gather that the phase of fighting in Syria, the actual conflict, has drawn some Islamist elements into the forefront of the fighting. Although I have to say, it's all very cloudy to me, and I don't know. I'm just saying there's a concern among people that this conflict phase could what happens during the conflict phase could determine who winds up in control of Syria, and that's assuming that we have a coherent post-conflict situation where there is a clear ruler, as opposed to something more chaotic than that.
I think the fact that Saudi and Qatar are arming the opposition suggests that they clearly support Islamist regimes or Islamic regimes, depend how you want to define it. But I actually think it's nearly impossible to know how it's going to play out. What happened in Egypt was very much that those who started the revolution of 2011 were young, were liberal, but those who had the political dominance and experience were the Muslim Brotherhood. And at the end of the day, if we are to believe, and I do at this point, that the elections were democratic, then I don't see the problem with the Brotherhood being in power at the moment. As long as democracy continues, and in 4 or 5 years' time, they'll have the opportunity to choose again. And by then, the liberal factions will be more prepared. And then it will be more of a fair competition. So politically, what has happened in Egypt is to be expected, bar the army or the military imposing itself and trying to pass illegal constitutions, and hopefully the spirit of the Egyptian people will continue, and they won't allow that to happen. In Syria, nobody has been strong. Anyone who was strong for the past decades of the Assad regime, be it from Bashar or his father Hafez, was just killed. Even individual thinkers, they were either imprisoned until they died or they were just killed. So there really isn't anybody you could say that has for a long time been strong in any opposition in any sense of the word. As I said, in Egypt they had the Brotherhood for decades, but in Syria there's no one. There's a real vacuum. And the fact that the SNC, the Syrian National Council, did such a poor job as a political opposition movement at the beginning is testament to that. Nobody had the experience. They have developed somewhat, but I don't see the Syrian people allowing them to take power after, or even electing them into power after the regime falls. But as you said, it depends how stable the country is after the regime falls. And how the regime falls will also matter. Will they flee, or will they be some kind of negotiation, or will they be killed? There are just far too many factors at the moment to know what's going to happen. And of course, every foreign country wants to plan it out to make sure that the next regime is in their favor. But it's quite impossible to do that at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And what is your sense for how the Assad regime's support is holding out among some of the constituents it had been counting on? I mean, for example, it was trying to keep the pretty substantial Christian population on its side, partly by frightening them about what would happen after an Islamist takeover of the government. It, of course, wants to keep the Alawites on its side, although I gather that there are some Alawites who are probably ambivalent and won't automatically side with your regime.
Absolutely.
With the regime. What is your sense for how those constituencies stand right now?
I don't think that sectarian tensions are going to develop the way the regime are trying to make them develop, because the Syrians have centuries of experience in living together and know that ultimately the regime has created these tensions by intentionally creating minority at the top. And it always has supported the Christians, so it's not an issue of religiously the Christians, or even as a minority the Christians are concerned, purely because they're a minority. It's because they are one of the minorities that benefited throughout the regime and knew that they were benefiting as a result of a dictatorship, while the majority were sidelined, marginalized, not taken care of. So that would be the concern. There are certainly many Christians that are part of the opposition. In fact, on both sides, whether pro or against the regime, you have people from all the religious sects. And it really, I think, boils down to how much did you benefit from the regime, how much do you stand to lose? And there are a lot of people who stand to lose. But the more it develops, for example, last month, there was a big influx of what you would call middle-class Syrians or middle to upper-class Syrians into Lebanon. These people have always owned a property in Lebanon. So for the during the first year, let's say, of the uprising, they were coming here quite regularly. But now I know of families that have actually moved. That means they think it's developing.
Wait, they've actually moved where?
To Beirut, to Lebanon.
Okay.
So middle-class Syrians have always owned property in Beirut. It's like their summer home or their weekend home.
Okay.
So it's not that it's a big deal they have to invest, but the move, leaving their work or their investments. A lot of people I know did stay there, whether they were merchants or professionals. They stayed in Syria out of concern for their property, and which is understandable. There has been some home invasions into properties that are known to be empty in Damascus. And, you know, one doesn't like to speculate, but just 1 week before, regime forces had been coming and doing a survey of those same areas. There's some nastiness happening, and people, middle class, who can afford to leave are feeling it, and they're leaving. So that also suggests there's a development, particularly in the capital, which was quiet for quite some time.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, is not the same as their kind of switching sides, staying in Syria and beginning to actively support the opposition, but still it's not good news for the regime.
No, and also they were never supporting the regime. They're apolitical. Most of them are apolitical. Some of them, particularly those who are actually not that wealthy but have benefited from the regime and feel that if they continue supporting it, they will get their just rewards. But at some point, everyone has their own individual tipping point. And so, for example, that's what we're talking about with army defections. Generals and colonels and foot soldiers, they all have a point where they say, I can't do this anymore. And I would rather risk my life and particularly my family's life, because they do go after family. And I have to switch sides or I have to just desert. So there are all sorts of people. I suppose one thing Bashar al-Assad said during the Barbara Walters interview is true. The majority are neither with him nor against him. They want their country to be peaceful. Certainly they would like democracy or at least regime change, because it was not doing a very good job of taking care of the country. The last few years, Syria has been through great difficulty, and the rich got richer and the poor got poorer. And there are many factors, financial crisis, but particularly drought, and none of this was well managed, so people really got to a point where they got fed up, of course inspired by the other countries. But yes, as he said then, the majority are just not really involved. So that tipping point could take some time to get there, but there are suggestions that people are giving up on the regime.
So what is your guess if the situation stays as it is, in the sense that the rebels continue to receive arms and perhaps increasingly substantial arms? I gather now anti-tank weapons are starting to trickle in. If that remains the case, but there is no outside assistance in the sense of actual troops or NATO jets or American jets or anything like that, or Saudi jets, what is your guess as to how long it would take for the regime to fall?
At the very beginning, last March, I had said 2 years. So not much has changed to suggest otherwise. I had thought that the regime would never back down. How long can you fight it out with the resources that you have? They have two or three strong brigades, but generally not a very strong army. This shipment from Russia that didn't reach Syria. If it finds its way to reaching Syria, yes, the regime will have more arms, but they need people, and they're actually losing people every day. So still months, but let's say not over a year. But it very much depends on whether people can be managed once the regime itself falls. So by the regime, it's not going to be enough to just remove Bashar al-Assad.
Right.
His brother will have to go, and some of the top dogs in the army will also have to go, and even in the government. Syria never rested on one man's shoulders. It's not like Libya where get rid of Gaddafi and everything is sorted, we can start afresh. In Syria, it's always been, let's say, 200 families that have held the power. It was certainly never Bashar on his own. His father would have had more power, but he was too young and inexperienced and doesn't have the gravitas to really do it on his own. So it wouldn't be enough for him just to go. His brother, the head of the 4th Brigade in Syria, that I understand is committing quite a few atrocities. He would definitely have to go, and a few others. But then it also depends. This is why the developments we hear about now in Turkey of the political opposition organizing itself, being in touch with the local coordination committees in Syria is so important, because that will create the bedrock for what happens once the regime goes. And the fact that there is this network, and it's been there for a long time, and they communicate via Skype, and they have posts in Lebanon and in Syria, and then the network throughout, in Lebanon and in Turkey, and then the network of local people and committees throughout Syria, there is this communication, and it's on many layers. One is with relation to distribution of arms, but one is also just to keep the lines open so that politically, they and in terms of humanitarian needs, that's always been open, but politically they can strengthen themselves so that there isn't a vacuum once the regime falls. But yes, your original question, how long? Impossible question, but let's say 6 to 12 months.
Okay, and is, do you favor the status quo I don't mean the status quo in Syria, but the status quo in terms of the amount of intervention that there is? In other words, providing arms and nothing more.
I suppose so. All the alternatives are too dangerous. It's very difficult to contain a war with international parties within Syria, considering its neighbors. Also, the Syrians themselves don't want it. They don't want to be saved by NATO. They're appreciative of the arms that they're getting. They need them to develop, but this is their war. Unfortunately, it shouldn't be this way. The regime should have backed off a long time ago, but there's this dogmatic obsession with holding on to power, and they will fight tooth and nail, but it seems, based on all the other options, there's very little else that can be done without a huge escalation.
I would think if I were a rebel and actually, was getting shot at by Syrian troops, I would be in favor of airstrikes. Isn't there, outside airstrikes to help?
It's not like Libya. Libya airstrikes, air support was quite easy, because first, geographically, the revolution spread from the east to the west. So you had your safe zone in the east, and you could progress further west. Also, it's a desert country, so there are vast amounts of land, and then this control and command center by the Gaddafi regime could be bombed without civilian casualties. In Syria, the military centers and the command and control centers and even the army barracks, they're all too close. They're within civilian areas. And the revolution itself has not developed from north to south or east to west. It's in pockets. The opposition control different pockets throughout the country, and the regime likewise. So how do you manage air support? I do know some who have suggested, well, if you just have targeted hits, so NATO can have, 100 targeted hits, the presidential palace, the army, the military barracks and Air Force barracks in Damascus, these kind that can be, NATO's obviously shown its capabilities in Libya, that they can do precision hits, that would perhaps encourage defections from the army, because then they would realize that they're done for. But the reality is also that's not going to happen, because they need a UN resolution for that. So sometimes it's one thing to talk about what would be ideal, it's another to talk about what could happen. And they just won't get a resolution for that, so NATO's just not going to get involved. But whether some precision hits would be helpful, perhaps. But I think the opposition can do it on their own, slowly but surely.
Okay, so you think, I mean, among the outside powers, there's no appetite for actual intervention, in your view. Among the rebels themselves, there's not a desperate cry for intervention, and there's some inclination to almost oppose intervention in the sense that they'd rather do it themselves. Go ahead.
These are the voices that are coming out. Of course, unfortunately, because journalists are not allowed safely in Syria, we don't hear the majority. So it's not that we can in any way suggest that we're talking for the majority of people in Syria. But the opposition, the activists and the armed opposition find their channels to communicate. And this is what we understand from them, is that they want to do it on their own so that they can take control of their country and not fear that it develop into Iraq, for example. Mm-hmm. And actually that would certainly be one of the reasons there's no appetite from America to get involved in Syria. The last thing they need, especially in an election year, is another Iraq. So I really don't see America backing anything more than what it's doing now, and the public there seem to be pleased enough with it, and so there's no reason for them to get involved.
So America doesn't want to again find itself in the role of occupying power, and the Syrian rebels don't want to find themselves occupied.
That's a simplified way of putting it. I don't think for America it's just about being the occupying power. It's about a completely failed operation. You go in with one intention and you come out with a big bill, having gained very little, and your constituents, in that case the American public, very upset with you. So it's a very simplified way of putting it, but certainly it's not going to encourage. Like I said, because of the geographic differences, a Libya-style operation is just not possible. Add to that the fact that Russia is still aligned with Syria, then you don't have a UN resolution.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when was the last time you were in Syria?
In November.
And what kinds of experiences did you have that were relevant to this or illuminating as far as where it's headed or as far as the nature of the tensions within Syria or whatever?
What's happening now, for example, and this has happened more since November, so in the last 7 months, I know people that continue to go there. The merchants are on strike. So these are the same Sunni merchants who in the 80s supported the regime and enabled them to resist the Muslim Brotherhood to a degree. Again, simplified, but the Sunni merchants were very important at that time in enabling the regime to continue. Now they're on strike, which means that many shops are closed, and they get threatened. There's the very famous Souq al-Hamidiya in Damascus, the long street of the old souq. And there was shooting there, the regime threatening people that if they don't open up their shops, they will be harassed, they will be imprisoned, they will be shot or tortured. But the strikes continue. And the idea is that this is our way of quietly showing we no longer support this. Different people find different ways to resist, obviously. Some write, some hold arms. And these men and women are closing their shops. Not that they can really afford to, but at the same time, there's not a lot of economic activity. So it's progressed, and as I said, a lot of the middle class have left Syria completely. That's how uncomfortable and unsafe they feel. Certain areas in Damascus were wonderful at night time, and now they're dead. In the old city, that's the Christian quarter, although really you had everybody there because it's just a wonderful place to be in, touristic area. And we would stay out till 3, 4, 5 in the morning, hobble back home, no problems, no safety issues, no This is obviously before the uprising. And now it's a ghost town by midnight. And certainly nobody would want to be walking alone. So, it's a changed city. Country.
And does this put productive pressure on the regime? I mean, both the merchant strike and the general kind of lack of economic activity?
Yes, it must do, because now even those who are apolitical, the majority who are neither here nor there, they just want this over and done with. Already before the uprising, there was economic hardship in Syria. But now this has put people in a very difficult position where the price of gas quadrupled at the beginning of the uprising. I don't know now how much it is. And that's if you can find it. We don't have central gas. We have those gas tanks that you attach to your ovens. Additionally, you fill up your heating system with diesel. And both these things are not to be found. And if they are, they're at least at quadruple the price they used to be, whereas salaries are either not being paid, or if they are, they're the same as they used to be. The dollar, or the value of the Syrian lira, has halved against the dollar. Economically, certainly when the country is reaching starving point, people who are apolitical will become politicized.
Because you said they just want it over one way or the other, but I gather the sense is the only way at this point it's going to end is for the regime to fall. It's too late for the regime to recover.
Absolutely. It is too late.
And that determines which side they will join as they do get politically active.
Yes, and some people, though, they are angry with the revolution. They are angry with the revolutionaries and the activists, because nobody expected it to last this long, to become this vicious. So they're almost feeling, I wish you didn't start this, because this isn't where it should have gone. But certainly it's not their fault. Much of what the opposition has done has been reactionary. The first sign of protest was children scribbling on a wall in graffiti based on what they had seen on TV from Egypt. And the reaction by the regime was to torture them and pull out their nails. So the opposition can only react based on what the regime has been doing. So unfortunately, yes, nobody had planned for this uprising to become so bloody. But that's why the regime can't survive, because they've taken it in a direction that nobody could forgive them for. And the apolitical will then perhaps continue to be upset that this revolution ever started in the first place, because we were better off before. But there's no way they can support the regime knowing that it's all based on the regime's actions and violence.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, listen, thank you for taking the time. This has been a very illuminating appraisal. And I hope that as things develop, maybe you'll have time to come back and update us.
Thank you, Bob. It would be my pleasure.
Okay. All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. Thank you.